Dude, I love the hat. I'm so happy to be wearing this hat. You know, I appreciate you bringing a hat, Dan. This is one of those things that when I first met you, I was like, yo, this hat is like, it's iconic. It's a character about you, man. So thank you.
Thank you. You have an amazing skull.
Thank you. You know, this hat right here, it says, I got my eyes on you. You know, we got the feather on it. And my biggest thing is the card on the inside. Okay. So, you know, there's the card on the inside, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if I can show the people in the crowd the card on the inside. If not, we'll take a photo and we'll overlay it for you guys. It says the Deer Slayer, the last of the, I'm sorry, I don't want to pronounce that wrong.
The last of the Mohicans.
Of the Mohicans, the spy, the pathfinder. Mm-hmm. What's so significant about this card and why did it make it inside the hat?
So I like to personalize all my hats, obviously. So I'm always looking for something to put in there that reflects some aspect of my personality or perhaps a role that I want to explore or embody when I'm wearing that hat, because the hat is kind of like a way of deciding who you're going to be that day.
Oh, interesting.
Does
so that's
understand
that's what the hats represent and reflect for you
to an extent.
Okay.
Because, you know, each, they're all my hats, they're all different, so they're all me, but they're all different me's that I want to be at that time, you know, without trying to sound like I'm schizophrenic or something, because that's not the point. But, you know, sometimes I'll wear something more casual, something that's more formal. Maybe it's springtime, maybe it's winter. I don't know, different hats. But in the case of that specific hat, the green felt lining that's in it and the fact that it was originally an Orvis brand hat, which is an outfitter, speaks highly to me of the classic experience of the great outdoors. Mm. You know, there was a time when we had a lot more freedom in the wilderness than we do today. And it's good that we have, you know, forest management and protection of those things, because those things were often misused or abused, I should say. But there was a time when America was wilderness. And to me, that's a very romantic time.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stories in that that are listed on that card are books by the author, James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote The Last of the Mohicans, which is an amazing story and also one of the greatest movies ever made, if you have seen it. It just speaks to an aspect of my personality that I want to explore more, even though we kind of live in a world where it's much harder to do that in an actual realistic way. We have to almost play these roles now.
I see what you're saying. One thing that I really loved is the, you know, there it was romantic, you know, when the world was full of just wilderness, you know, and I can resonate and I can reflect with that. Just speaking from my personal experience, in Mount Pocono, there is a route called 940.
Yes.
And now if you go to that route, it is, pretty much an industrial park. And I remember just seeing, I grew up in the Poconos, you know, I grew up seeing trees and trees and trees, right next to that Walmart, right next to that hotel. And now all you just see is infrastructure. And the sad part is I can't picture or remember the trees being there, but I know they were there, you know? And that's one of those things.
It's interesting and kind of ironic that you mentioned that. I lived in Mount Pocono, in the Mount Pocono campground in the early 1990s. And that is when I more or less lived on a mountain bike and just rode for miles and miles a day through the woods, through the back country roads. And, you know, it was a little bit of a Huck Finn lifestyle. You know, we would just get out there and find out whatever we could do in the woods for fun, building forts, swimming. And there are stories there too.
Just connecting with nature.
But it has changed so much. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time up there in almost 30 years, but I have visited there in the last couple of years for different reasons or passed through. In fact, this summer I took a ride, 940 out to Blakesley to visit a flea market. And it was amazing to me how many things had changed. There were still certain things that hadn't, you know, some landmarks and whatnot, but it was definitely a different place.
It's so it, for some people it's exciting, for other people it's upsetting. You know, for me, just being from that area, I look back and I'm like, damn, that's really upsetting, not being able to remember where the trees were and how there was such a large abundance of trees there, and it's just not there anymore. So, you know, with that being said, everyone, welcome to the Middleman Podcast. I am the man in the middle, Kevin Martinez. I'm sitting here with Dan, the Renaissance man. Thank you for being here. Thanks for joining me here. All these lovely rings, your hat, your style, man. I met you downstairs, you know, as we were having a drink. And what did I say to you? I said, we always have these very, you have a very intricate mind, and we always have these really calm conversations, man. You know how to carry yourself, and you know how to represent a certain form of wisdom that, you know, I'm just not accustomed to hearing or thinking of, you know. So that's why I was so eager to invite you to the show, and I'm happy you're here with me today. You know, Dan, the Renaissance man, you know, you sent me a plethora of topics to pick from. But let's just start out with the main one, you know, Renaissance living, you know, to live in a modern Renaissance. What is that to you? I did do a little bit of research to Google, you know, what does that mean if you were to Google it? But in your own verbiage, what does it mean to you to be living a modern day Renaissance life?
First of all, thank you. Of course. That was an excellent and fantastic way to be received today. And I really appreciate the entrepreneurship that you have here with this podcast, and the way that you're curious and you ask a lot of questions and you want to get to know more. And I'm very honored to have a chance to explain some of those things and not only to help you and others maybe learn a few things, but to define it even better for myself.
Wonderful.
So, your question, the Renaissance, I don't want to go into a great history lesson.
You don't have to.
You can, but you could. But you can all Google and YouTube the same things that I did to find out how this lifestyle kind of works. But the word Renaissance basically means rebirth.
Okay.
Or new birth. And it came from a period of time in Italy and Europe, that central kind of area of which we think of as East, but it's really Western thought, about 500 years ago. And it's typified by some of the world's greatest artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael. And at that time, the world had just basically been coming out of what we know as the Dark Ages, which was a time of intellectual suppression, largely under the power of the church and religion at that time. And the world was still more or less controlled by religion and aristocracies and classes of people in a way that we don't have exactly the same thing today. But when the Renaissance came into its fullness, people were fascinated by art and science, and there was enormous growth of knowledge and understanding and advances in technology, advances in society. And I feel like we are in a period that is every bit as transformational in the world today as it was 500 years ago. For in different ways and for different reasons, but the notion that the world is full of new possibility and that we stand in a great position to make our own new meanings out of things is, to me, a hopeful one. And the world is so full of things that are difficult to cope with right now, change. And there's a lot of things that feel negative or destructive. And I find that for me personally, the best ways to cope with that is to find a way to ride with it a little bit.
Okay. I like that. Instead of going against it, ride with it.
Well, to go back to the way we just started the conversation, mm-hmm. talking about, well, remember when it was all wilderness and trees in the Poconos, and
yes.
then you go out there and now it's all just, you know, a suburb of New York.
Yeah, that's okay. a great way to put it.
Well, maybe that's true, but instead of just lamenting it and saying, well, you know, it's time to move on, this isn't worth my time, or it's sad, let's maybe look at it and say, well, what are the opportunities here? What is the, what's good in this? What's beautiful in this? Mm. What has meaning in this? How can we take what's in front of us now and make it something that is, that at least has utility, but hopefully also beauty at the same time?
Understood, understood. So, you know, you mentioned like a feeling of reborn, you know, Renaissance, reborn, right?
Right.
So, you know, this definitely wasn't your way of life since day one.
No.
You know, I was reading some of the information that you gave me. I think your school and your education is very important and definitely a different route as to what most people would do. So I just wanted to, you know, backpack into that. No, we're. What? My audio cut out? Check, check. No, we're good. Yeah, we're good. Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Do you want to do another take?
No, we're all good. We're all good. We're just going to keep it rolling. So as I was saying, reborn, you know, when did this shift start for you? When did you want to take on this type of lifestyle? And what was your lifestyle prior to this type of modern day Renaissance that you are embarking now in this journey?
This show is only an hour and a half, right?
Yeah. Well, it's about an hour, you know, but
an hour. There's an awful lot of backstory, but I'll give you a few, key things.
Okay.
I was raised in a very strict religious, family that was very closed to the world, to anything that was not, consistent and reinforcing of the very narrow set of beliefs and standards that my family held. And it took a very long time for me to find ways to get out of that way of thinking and that way of behaving, those kinds of mindsets and personal beliefs. And I should say also during that time, I had some unique or particular nuances about myself that at the time could be considered gifts. I was fairly advanced in my reading and in my verbal abilities. I was creative. I was a self-starter. I was an explorer and an imaginer. And those are all the kind of things that a lot of kids have. And those are the kind of qualities that I think are important to try to cultivate. And I think my parents wanted me to be able to do that as long as it was within the confines of what was okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up in the 1980s, I went to public school for 2 years. I had kindergarten, first grade, but I had already learned how to read before I ever started school.
Ah.
And I became engrossed in the encyclopedias that we no longer have today when I was 5, 6 years old. So we didn't have internet either. It was mm-hmm. all just books, but I loved the encyclopedias and I read them constantly. So I was full of just knowledge about this world out there. And I had already kind of learned how to read and have conversation when the other kids were still learning the alphabet. But I was socially not advancing.
Gotcha. Okay.
So yeah. There was this very annoying and precocious and presumptuous little boy in a class full of other kids who always had the answer and always wanted to be, you know, engaging with the adults, and I didn't fit in. So, you know, in the 80s, there was no real special ed.
That must have been difficult.
It was difficult. I got frustrated. I got bored. I didn't socialize well.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really know what to do with me at that time. And I wasn't athletic very much. They kept moving me up the grades. So I got up to like fifth grade.
Wow.
When I was like seven.
Wow.
Because that was as high as the elementary school went. And that was as far as my reading development was. So now all the kids were twice my size.
Yep.
And it just wasn't working out.
It also, that didn't help so much with the social aspect of it.
No, I was very frustrated, and I would get into arguments with people, and not really so much physical altercations, maybe here and there a little bit, but I was just overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. I was out of out of water. And my parents basically tell me that I came home and said, I don't ever want to go back. And so they were like, all right, fine. They don't know what they're doing. We're just going to homeschool them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was the oldest of four kids. And I think at first, for a couple of years, that kind of worked out. It was more or less okay. Again, this was before the internet. But it gave me a lot of freedom to become an explorer and a consumer of knowledge in a time when we didn't have the internet.
Gotcha. Okay? Gotcha.
So it was all books, and it was all things that I did at home on my own. We were obviously still very active in the church, and between church and being homeschooled, that was pretty much my life. And my world became smaller because of that, because I wasn't out with people and I wasn't out learning about the world and doing other things. I was just doing church and then more or less whatever I felt like doing at home to putter and create and play.
Self-educate.
And as my younger siblings came up, they never went to public school.
Mm.
They needed more attention than I did. More responsibility came on to me. And I would say that from maybe eighth grade on through the end of high school, I essentially schooled myself.
Wow.
Which there are pluses and minuses to that. And there were other things, obviously, that were going on in my life besides this. As I matured into my teenage years, we got into some other things. But you can only teach yourself so much, especially with math and the sciences.
Yes.
So I came out with really, really great reading and writing skills. But I was very much lacking socially, and I was very much lacking in math and the sciences. But I knew that I was also very mechanically inclined.
Yes.
So
certainly,
you know, to kind of bring things back a little bit toward the topic of the Renaissance, if you picture or if you know anything about Leonardo da Vinci, he was born of very low birth. He was an illegitimate child and he had a very hard upbringing. And he became a self-starter and a self-educator. He was someone who realized, you know, I'm not going to get opportunities just handed to me because of who my parents were. I need to become a person of value, become a person of worth and potential by exploring and crafting and honing my skills so that people who do have resources and people who do have opportunity are going to want to bring me into their world or their employ, so that he became more or less a self-made man through his intellect and through his creativity and through his passion about exploring the world around him naturally. And I think that that comes about because that was a time when you could do some things like that. Nowadays, we cram all the kids into schools and we have a one-size-fits-all education system that basically says you are going to go and get a job and you need to learn how to sit still and pay attention and take direction and wear a certain uniform of clothing so that you can participate in the way that our capitalism works.
That's the thing is, you know, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, I was reading this one book called Outwitting the Devil by Napoleon Hill, I believe his name is. And he was speaking about how school, you know, in a form, you know, they were saying the devil, right? Just how do we get children out of their creative mindset, you know? And the form was schooling, you know, putting them in this type of thought process that you have to get through school, graduate, go to college, you know, and live by the bounds that society has bestowed upon everyone, you know, that this is the way that life goes, you know. 9 times out of 10, people are just, we're all chasing for money. And we can't even take it when we die. But unfortunately, that's how our world is just, that's how it works. So that's how you have to play the game, essentially. But with that being said, you know, school does take that creativeness out of you. You know, it does put you in that box, you know, and you realize that. And, you know, Leonardo da Vinci here, definitely a man of brilliant mind. What's the book you have here? How to Think Like Da Vinci.
This is an older book I've had for a number of years. It's called How to Think Like Da Vinci by a man named Daniel Smith. Obviously, it's not a very thick book, but it gives highlights of his life and his way of seeing things. The point I wanted to make is that whether you believe that you're in a society that tells you that you must conform to a certain pattern, or you believe that you live in a society full of possibility and wonder and you can become anything you want, you're right. It's a question of what do you believe? And unfortunately, we set kids up to believe that they're in that society that says, you are going to do these things and here's how you're going to do them. And I believe that was also true in Da Vinci's time. He went into guild of art training, and because at that time artists were in great demand, they wanted a lot of art being made, sculpture, painting, everything, and they needed skilled craftsmen to go and make it. And so they would put kids into these training programs that would go through their adolescence, and people would rise up and eventually become artists, and they would try to find patrons. You know, today it's like, well, we go to college to try to get jobs. So it was more of a blue collar kind of approach at that time. But I think what made him special was that, as opposed to the other kids that were just maybe mimicking and trying to become what they were supposed to become, he just had this incredible curiosity. He had this incredible thirst to really understand and know the world and how it worked, and combine that with incredible powers of observation. So,
could he personally resonate with you in a personality with that statement that you just made?
That's exactly where I was just headed with it, is that I'm not Leonardo da Vinci. I'm not the amazing genius and polymath that he was, but I would say that he's a role model for me in terms of my spirit and in terms of my approach to the world. And unfortunately, I went through very long spans of time in my life where my circumstances tended to dampen that out.
Okay.
So I'm coming back to now where you said, how did you become this person? Because the Renaissance is about rebirth. Okay. So I started out as a kid who had maybe similar proclivities or similar habits or approaches to certain things, which I think was a consequence of the fact that homeschooling with limited supervision, to the extent that it was like, you know, Dan's pretty smart and Dan is very resourceful and Dan can kind of just figure it out on his own, and we have all these other kids that need more attention. That gave me a lot of freedom to explore that and really cultivated that attitude in me, but I was constrained by the religious framework and the lack of access to the real world through both social interaction and no internet.
Gotcha.
Not because we didn't want internet, but internet just wasn't around yet. until, you know, the 90s when I was about ready to go to college anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I think was a little bit of a double-edged sword in that was I had been raised in a family that was very patriotic and okay. that valued national service, which are wonderful things. And I had a strong desire to be a career military man.
Okay.
I wanted to go to a service academy. I wanted to go into the Air Force Academy and become an officer and retire from military service. And that was something that was important to me from my teenage years. Unfortunately, my parents didn't necessarily believe that that was realistic.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, with them being patriotic, I thought they really would have supported that.
They supported me being in the military. They didn't believe that there was any way I would make it to an academy.
Ah, okay.
For officership. Hmm. And I think my parents were also very protective and very guarding, and they were very nervous about, well, we really want to let him have this military experience, but we want to keep him close to home.
Gotcha.
Okay. And that was very destructive to my confidence and to my belief about what I could be. You know, instead of saying, well, we'll do anything we can to support you, it was more like, here's what we can give, so can you just maybe work with that?
Yeah, yeah.
So 2 weeks prior to 9/11,
mm-hmm.
I was a freshman at Penn State University.
We are.
I had just started my very first classes because it was September.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I had also just signed enlistment papers to go into the Air Force Reserve as an airman.
Were your parents aware of this?
Yes, they okay. supported that okay. very much. They didn't support me going away to a big school. They more or less said, you have to go to college. We can't pay for it. You have to pay for it. You're not leaving home, so you basically have to go to Penn State here in Dunmore,
mm-hmm.
which... nothing against that. That's fine. But it was like that or nothing.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
So I signed up for Penn State, but I had also enlisted. And a lot of people were saying, well, how are you going to do both at the same time?
Yeah.
I don't know. No one ever explained to me that what I didn't have any concept of what real school was like because I'd been homeschooled. And I didn't have any concept of what it was going to take for me to prioritize that while also serving in the military. Now, yeah. they tell you that reserve service is part-time, and you go weekends and whatnot. And that's true, but there's actually a lot more commitment to it than that. Well, it was 2 weeks before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So we had been, as a country, at peace for a very long time. And there was no active threat of war, right?
Yes.
I had signed the papers, and 9/11 happened. And then everything changed.
Yes.
Especially for a person going into the service not expecting those things to occur the way that they had. So I went into basic training, and my military life more or less totally eclipsed my college experience. I did not end up deploying to an active war zone. Virtually all of my service was stateside. I had a few trips out of the country for various reasons, but they were short term.
May I ask you what your job was in the military?
I did public affairs.
Public affairs, okay.
So I went to a journalism school.
Okay.
A government journalism school, and I learned photography and writing as well as other skills. And then I became a public affairs specialist for the military. So I did a lot of, news and sports and special feature writing in support of the military's operations. And I met a lot of really important people, a lot of elected officials, community leaders, things like that. And more, my job was mostly to tell the story of the people that were doing more of the heavy lifting.
Gotcha.
And I really enjoyed that. It was a very rich experience, but I also recognized that kind of left me a little bit detached from some of the things that really brought the the drama to the service for a lot of other people, or the impact of war and trauma and things like that, didn't necessarily hit me that hard.
Understood.
You understand? But it completely threw a wrench in the works for me with college for a number of reasons. And college kind of took a backseat. So I lost the opportunity to expand my world and my understanding of liberal arts, partly because I had been relegated to a school that was in my town that I could commute to from home. Mm-hmm. And partly because as a military reservist, my focus was on these other things.
And on those specific topics as well. So it's not like you were allowed too much creativity with the government, you know, writing assessments so much. Maybe not so much a topic, but when writing on it, you could expand your creativity.
I feel like it fed my creativity more than stifled it, because I was a writer and a photographer, and I did a lot of graphic arts too.
Okay.
And there was a lot of freedom to play with that, and that really enriched some of my skills. But I was in a structure of a hierarchy with rank and with rules and uniforms. And, you know, I didn't have long hair and a beard. I had to wear clean shaven face.
I can't even imagine you like that.
I have some pictures. I was very baby face. So I was very, I don't want to say rigid. I wasn't rigid, but I was locked into certain ways of thinking and certain ways of interacting with the world that I feel overall kept me a smaller person than I could have been, and that took me away from opportunity, or caused me to shy away from opportunity, because I have to take some responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to be an agent for my own behavior, that just because I was raised in a certain tradition and because certain circumstances kind of gave me mindsets, I lacked confidence. I lacked the freedom of thought that it took for me to be able to make certain leaps to grow and to experience my youth, my adolescence, my young adulthood to their fullness. And I regret that. So my rebirth, my renaissance, has come as a fully mature adult. I'm now in my 40s. I'll be 41 next week. And it came after my father has passed a little over 5 years ago.
Hmm.
So a lot more responsibility came onto my shoulders. I had a wife and I had a son. My wife and I are separated at this time for quite a while. And we work together on co-parenting. But the weight of adult responsibility really started to cause me to ask a lot more questions about, wait a minute, how do things really work?
Yes.
Especially when my son came up and I started to be in situations where I had responsibility to make choices for a child, that caused me to look back to that time in my own life and say, I know what I experienced.
Yes.
I know what my parents believed. I know what that meant for me at that time. But that doesn't make sense to me now. I don't think that's how I'm going to proceed in raising my son. So raising my son, coming into the fullness of adult responsibility in that manner, and following my career in the military, which was almost 10 years long.
Thank you for your service, by the way.
You're very welcome. I appreciate it. Put me at a place where I was finally not only prompted to really question it all, but to be in a position of responsibility and agency and personal freedom to act upon it without feeling like the weight of either family or religion or the boundaries of military service or anything like that were constraining me from making choices. I felt before that I couldn't do certain things or even if I wanted to or I shouldn't. Now I felt like, well, I get to decide for myself. And I dove into that head first and deeply. And I started questioning everything. I started looking at things more reservedly, in the sense that I'm not going to approach everything that I see from the standpoint that I already have a worldview and an opinion about that. And I already think that I know what it means. And I decided I'm just going to let things kind of speak for themselves. And I needed to do that because I needed to rewrite my map of the world.
I think that's brilliant, especially because, you know, one of the key points that you touched on is, you know, you had a son, and the ideas and the situations that were brought upon, you know, as you as a father to have to tell your son, you know, maybe how to handle X, Y, and Z, you know, you probably thought back, you reminisced to how your parents taught you how to get through X, Y, and Z, but you realize that that's not the way that you think is, that may not be the best way to get to X, Y, and Z. So you started to question, you know, and you started to educate and learn. And, you know, I commend you for that, because it's a realization, it's a self-thought to be like, okay, that just doesn't apply anymore. Times are a little bit different. What's the best way to go about this? And, you know, project it onto your son and hopefully, you know, get him into the right direction, you know, 100%. And what's this book you got here, if you don't mind me asking, the second book we have here?
So recently, Rick Rubin, who is a music producer for a lot of famous bands, has released a book called The Creative Act. It's a way of being, which I wasn't sure exactly what it was or who he was when I saw it on the shelf. But over the summer, I was going through some difficult levels of evolution here, because the things that I'm describing to you are things that have more or less manifested within the last few years. So it's very difficult to come out of a religious framework, no matter what it is, and not replace it with something, because you're handed a way of thinking and a way of view of the world. And when you decide that that doesn't make sense or fit anymore, well, you achieve freedom, but with freedom, you also assume responsibility, and you have to kind of create your own map of the world if you don't think that that way works.
I like that. With freedom, you assume responsibility.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the United States of America, and I think that we all recognize that freedom is something that you earn, and that's in keeping with the theme of my military service, that you have to work to keep your liberty. So when you get it, now you have to figure out what to do with it. And that was not an easy task by any means. It's the most frightening, the most overwhelming, and most human thing I think anyone can do is to take responsibility for making their own meaning out of the chaos of the world. And, you know, sometimes you look back and you say, I wish that I had a guide.
A guide, you know? Yeah, okay.
And we can find guidance from many sources. Most recently for me, this book by Rick Rubin, which is a series of entries. He has 78 short entries where he talks about embodying the life of creativity for the artistic way. It's art as a way of being. And that immediately called to me off the shelf.
Yeah.
Because I feel like meaning making, no matter what it is pretty much the essential human thing. Whatever it is that makes us human beings, it has to do something with the fact that everything that we do needs to mean something to us.
Yes, okay? Certainly. So the meaning of life, the biggest question of all, right? Right?
Well, it's the question we all have to answer for ourselves.
Exactly.
Which I didn't grow up learning that. I believed it was the question that you needed to seek the answer that someone else had that you didn't have. And now I know that it's about you creating that. Okay? we're not just receivers, we're creators.
Yes.
Okay. And that creation is an act. It's a thing. And so it's work. And Rick Rubin has led a life of leading and guiding creative people to realize their dreams and their passions and their interests into the public consciousness through mostly music. But he's collected his whole life wisdom and knowledge into these short little sections that talk about how to do that. And in a sense, it is kind of become like a devotional for me.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be a person that read devotionals as a religious person. I stopped doing that, but then there was nothing else there. And so I took up with journaling.
Okay.
A lot of journaling. And I did a lot of writing. And that was a very healthy form of self-growth and therapy. But it can also be a soup in your head. Like you're just kind of repeating your own voice to yourself and you get locked into it and you need something else from outside, right? And his voice was very clear and very compelling. And sometimes, you know, it hits like out of nowhere. You don't know what, you never saw it that way. You never thought of it. So what I've been doing over the summer is every morning I will get up and I will read one of these entries and just ponder on it. And it may not have anything to do with what I'm doing right now, but it's reminding me that there's a way of being and that you have to embody it. And it can apply to anything that you choose to do.
The way you just said that, I got to get this book. I mean, I'm the title, it says it itself, the creative art, way of
creative
being. The creative act, a way of being. And, you know, a way of being, like being, you know, how everyone has that question, how should I be, you know, a way of being, the creative act, we're all creators, as you said, you know. So I'm definitely going to look into this. I'm really excited to look into this for sure, because it definitely seems like it's helping you a lot. And it sounds like a very intricate and a brilliant book to open up your mind and let you just read passages and just try to understand a way of being, essentially. So with that being said, I know you mentioned guide, right? You know, we're all looking for guidance. And I know what we were talking. One of the words that I saw was a guidepost, you know, setting up future guideposts for yourself. Can you elaborate on that? I'm not too sure as to what you meant by that.
So we live in the present.
Yes.
We live right now. We have a past that got us here, and we are headed toward a future. And there's certain things that we can control and certain things that we can't. There's a lot of ambiguity. And so I try now to embrace that and accept that it's part of the adventure of living, is to embrace the chaos and the disorder and the fact that nothing is really meaningful until you make it meaningful. Because there is so much to absorb. There is so much to observe, but that can be very overwhelming, especially when you are coming from a background that at least on the surface appeared to make sense and be more orderly. It can be frightening. And sometimes I feel like I lose my way. I feel like I become confused or overwhelmed or indecisive. And that's when I know that I need to kind of anchor again. And you have to have something to anchor to. If you just drop your anchor in the water, it's not going to keep the boat from moving unless there's something solid.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to learn how to create those things for myself. So I use the word guidepost, but I think a better word would be something more like anchoring points.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Ways to keep you grounded.
Physical fitness is absolutely number one. Grounding myself in rigorous exercise and discipline and matching that with a certain attitude of ritual. So, like, because ritual is one of the things that helps us to take our actions and make them habits, but also give them meaning at the same time. You know what I mean?
That's brilliant. I love it.
fitness is often a challenge for a lot of people to stay motivated with, or maybe it...
stay disciplined with.
Maybe it becomes something that you see an extra thing that you have to do after you've done everything else that is important to you. But for me, it's the starting point for my day, most days, as often as possible. And it is frequently the most important thing I feel like I'm going to do. At least I give myself that prompt that I'm now coming here to, I'm showing up. Okay. And I'm showing up to do this important thing. And however well or however badly it goes doesn't matter. What matters is that I did it.
Yes.
Okay. And then I get all the mental and physical benefits that come from that. And that helps to organize and order my day. So that's an anchor point that helps me today, but is also building a path for the future. You know, I'm maintaining physical fitness and health and vitality as best as I can at the same time as I'm also accepting that I'm going into middle age.
it's a way to keep yourself grounded. I like that. I enjoy that, you know, go ahead.
But it's also a way to set yourself up for success tomorrow.
Yes.
Because we're talking about these guideposts toward the future. So that's one thing, physical fitness. Another thing to me is making the time and the space each day to try to engage or receive some kind of art or some kind of beauty of some sort, so that days are not just about being on the grind. The grind is important. Like, you need to be working, you need to be going after your goal, but you need to be alive today, because you may have heard it said that life is what happens while we're making other plans. And I have been very guilty of that for a very long time, about living for a tomorrow that may or may not come. And I think that's something that was taught into me as a child through religion, is that you're storing up your treasures in heaven. You're living for eternity in heaven with God, and you need to mind those boundaries. And I have no, I don't want to discourage anyone who lives that way from thinking that they shouldn't. I don't want to disrespect or disparage that, but I know that for me, that caused me to not pay attention to a lot of things that were meaningful and beautiful and important, opportunities for growth in the present, because I was too worried about forever.
Yes.
You know, not just tomorrow, not just the future, but like forever. And I don't want to do that anymore. So I want to be mindful of the future. I want to set the future up for success. I want to constantly be building opportunities to flourish and reach my fullest potential, and to encourage others and be a role model to do the same. But I want to do that by making the most of what I can of each day.
Today.
Today.
Got it. That's beautiful, man. I love that. I love that so much. Listen, you are a well-rounded individual, an extremely well-rounded individual. You know, when I looked up Renaissance, you know, Renaissance living, you know, the way it was described to me is just being well-rounded, you know, being able to have all types of, you know, hats to put on. And essentially, you are one of those well-rounded individuals, my friend. You know, some of your hobbies, you know, we have these rings here, we have the hat. You know, you even mentioned your style. You know, there's a whole lot that goes on within you, and I love it, because it seems like you're sure of yourself, but you're also questioning yourself every day that you wake up. You know what I mean? Am I wrong to say that?
No, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Okay,
and I would also point out that you don't become sure of yourself until you start questioning you. And then when you question and you find answers, then you become sure.
Absolutely. Listen, we have like about 10 more minutes here before we get into tea time. I want to talk about so much more, man, because you really are a fantastic individual, man. You know, but is there anything that you want to touch upon before we switch and transition into tea time? You know, right now, I don't want to deter the conversation from anywhere else. You know, I want to utilize these last few minutes the best we can.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Of course.
I think that it's very important to me as I'm establishing this new way of living for myself. And I want to be clear that this is not how I've always been. It's something that I'm building now that I want to try to help other people to be inspired to do similar things. I feel like the age that we live in, especially with the rise of AI and the way that that is disrupting everything.
So disruptive.
And also empowering everything means that we are at a very critical point in human history in the development of our potential as people, that now is the best time to grab on and take it for all it's worth, live it for all it's worth, and give ourselves permission to do that without fear and without regret. So I want to try to encourage people to push more toward the edges of their discomfort zones and to grow into them, and to do it through first I would say the best word is through wonder. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wonder in the sense of being curious about, hey, I wonder what's over there, but also wonder in the sense of awe and appreciation for the things that we discover when we are curious. Okay. So I think that is the defining characteristic of the Renaissance spirit, whether it's in the classical Renaissance or the modern one, is to be curious and to be full of wonder and to give ourselves permission to indulge it more than we usually would.
And you know, for people who are wondering how they can bring a Renaissance type of lifestyle to the modern day and age, you just answered it with a question, with wonder, you know, mm-hmm. with wonder, with excitement, with trying to figure out what this world and why this has been placed in front of you, why you're here, and just try to understand it, man. And I wish we had more time, Dan. Sheesh,
well,
man.
That's okay, because this is a life journey, so we have our whole lives.
Yes.
But I would encourage anyone that's interested in exploring this, cultivate that spirit of wonder, first of all. And then secondly, begin to become more in touch with your senses. And try to do it without preconception and without judgment. Just see what you see and hear what you hear and taste and feel and experience the world through your senses, because we are essentially, as a living being, you are an electromagnetic field, okay?
Okay.
That is embodied within an envelope of water and stardust, okay? So you should live like that.
Love that.
Whatever that means, okay? What that means is that you are experiencing reality through your nervous system, your eyes, your ears, your senses, your touch, and all of that is coming in and imposing upon your brain, your mind, and becoming part of who you are. Take note of that.
Okay.
That is something that Da Vinci did. He would stare at things and he would see connections that were there that we just don't pay attention to. Like, for example, the commonality between the mathematics of how long hair flows and how water flows in a river.
Okay.
Okay. We talk about flowing locks of hair.
Yes.
And we talk about rivers flowing. Well, he saw that and he recognized that those things were mathematically similar, partly because he was a genius. But what he really had was a passion for observing the natural world. Okay. So I encourage people, to cultivate that within themselves. Become grounded with your body and become coordinated, become physically fit and explore how you interact with your world and perceive it and take it in as your, as part of your sense. And do it without necessarily trying to filter all that through your present worldview and your present conception, but just receive. And as you start to do that, and as you start to engage with wonder, then you can start to synthesize. You can start to create, and you can start to bring more things into the world that, that surrounds you.
Brilliant. So Dan, at the end of the show, we usually ask people to give a message for the people, but I feel like that was a message right
there.
Well,
you asked me what I wanted to give. And so what I want to do with the last 10 minutes is to give that message to everyone else that we live in a renaissance now. And I challenge and I encourage everyone to embrace that for all it's worth, because someday you will be gone and someday all of this will be gone, and whether it mattered or not, will be forgotten. But you should make the most of the experience that you have while you are living it.
While you're in it. Yes, sir. Dan, thank you so much for coming out to the show, man. It's been a pleasure. Dan, the Renaissance man, fantastic conversation. We're going to get you back on the show 100%. I will definitely have to get this book myself. Read it, indulge in it. You know, I will definitely be having conversations with you downstairs at the bar, whatever the case may be.
Sure.
Because, you know, man, you are full of wisdom. You're a brilliant dude. You think about life. And those are the people I want to surround myself with. You know, people who are just thinking about different ways of the way you should live your life. You know, everyone has a different way to live a life. And your way may not be better or worse than anyone else's, but at least it's an opportunity for me to learn and maybe take tidbits of how to make my life better. So with that being said, we're going to transition into tea time. Not brought to you by, but inspired by Arizona Iced Tea. I am the man in the middle, Kevin Martinez, signing out. Peace.